Radio National. When our old mate Joe Banks returned to England after that 1770 voyage to New Holland with James Cook, he brought back with him a collection of, well, butterflies. Now, the fascination with these fragile creatures, Banks and others, isn't very well known as a part of our European settlement history. It's also a part of our art history, and the National Library holds a remarkable collection of paintings of butterflies by naturalists who combined a love of science with a love of art. And the book's just been published to essentially share these works with the rest of us, because they tend to be kept away from public view. Michael Braby, an entomologist with the Northern Territory Government and a fellow student at Eltham High School, is the main author, along with Penny Olsen. Michael, welcome to our little radio program.
Thank you, Philip, and yeah, thank you for that lovely introduction.
Now, Joe returned enthusiastically with his collection of butterflies from this continent. That was in a period when the quest to order the natural world was absolutely in full swing, wasn't it?
That's right, and it's interesting you mentioned Banks. We often think of Banks as being the great botanist, but of course him and Solander were general naturalists at that time, and that voyage with Cook in 1770, and they collected everything, including small things like butterflies.
Was there anything particularly extraordinary about Australian butterflies?
Not at that time, but of course now we have a much better understanding of the dynamics of the fauna, and I guess there's two things that really stand out about the Australian butterfly fauna, just speaking generally. Is one is that we don't have a huge number of species compared to the other continents.
Why is that?
It's a good question. It's something we're not really sure.
Is it because we've got so many birds?
It's partly due to the fact that Australia is a very arid continent. 75% of the country is quite arid. And butterflies being sort of moisture-loving insects, they have a caterpillar stage which is quite vulnerable to low humidity.
You're telling me caterpillars dehydrate here, do they?
That's exactly right. So dry conditions are not really conducive. So if you take out 75% of our continent, we don't really have a huge landmass that's really available for those kind of insects. So that's probably partly the factor, but I think the other thing too, we don't really understand the full history of where our fauna came from, which components were here when Australia was joined to Antarctica, Gondwana, back in 30 million years ago, and which ones actually came in quite recently from Southeast Asia as the Australian continental plate crashed into the Asian plate.
Now, by the early 19th century, butterfly collecting and depiction was, quote, an educated hobby.
Yes. Yeah, and I think that period was when art and science and natural history were all intertwined, and it was not unusual for scientists, taxonomists, to illustrate their species and to have a really good field knowledge. I think today we've kind of lost that connection. And I guess one of the goals of this book is to really try and draw that connection that art and science are really, well, were very closely related. And today we've kind of perhaps moved away from that.
I want you to tell the Gladys about George Angus.
Yes. When you mentioned earlier, like Australia was, when collections were being established overseas, and there was this real thirst for knowledge to build up their collections. And Australia was one of those kind of faraway lands that was seemed to be thought to be very rich in biology and wildlife. And people like Angus and John Loomis, another one, they were sort of young, intrepid explorers who really wanted to come here and try and make their name. So they were able to get financial sponsorship. And their goals were to try and
Sorry to keep interrupting, but you say things which I find intriguing. Financial sponsorship by whom or from whom? The other night on the program, I played a piece of poetry by John Laws, which was paid for by Bradford Insulation, but they weren't around then. So who paid for people like George Angus?
George Angus may have actually been sponsored by his father, but John Lewin definitely got sponsorship from eminent scientists, like a name which probably won't mean too much to anybody, but a guy called Drew Jury, and some other wealthy patrons. And they came here to try and build up collections, make their artwork, and then the idea was then return back to England and sort of make their fortune. Mm. Unfortunately, in some cases, that never happened. But Angus, he arrived in Adelaide in the 1840s, I think 1844, and he spent the first few years doing some amazing trekking. He got down into what's now present-day Mount Gambier before really he was probably one of the first white people to really explore that country. And he compiled a series of folios of mostly of Aboriginal people, but also landscapes. But amazingly, there's this incredible piece of work that portrays a whole series of butterflies and moths, many of which he thought were new. And when he went back to England, one of the entomologists at the British Museum, Edward Doubleday, actually described them for him, and he actually published quite a few new species based on that painting.
What about the fabulous Scott sisters, Harriet and Helena?
Yeah, their work's just incredible, isn't it? And I think it's probably unrivaled, actually. I can't think of any work that's as good as the Scott sisters in terms of just the sheer beauty and the intricacy and the fine detail. And they were trained by their father, Alexander Walker Scott, and they spent about 20 years on Ash Island in the Hunter Valley of Newcastle from the mid-1840s to about the about 1866. And during that period, they reared a lot of insects. A lot of the life histories and things that they were cultivating and rearing would have been quite new, quite novel. And they not only painted the insects, and their father did the scientific descriptions, but they also captured the food plants and the habitats. So it's quite extraordinary, that work being done then. I mean, that was just so far ahead of their time. Even back in England, there was nothing being done of that kind of that level, that standard. So there's no surprise that when their work was eventually published, that they received recognition from the Entomological Society of New South Wales.
The Scott sisters, you tell us, worked under male patronage, but Louisa Ann Meredith didn't. Who was she? And how did she end up in Van Diemen's Land?
Yes. She was a highly educated woman. She was very gifted with poetry, writing, and illustration, drawings. And she actually married her cousin, who was a wealthy pastoralist who had some properties around the Sydney district. And again, after she was married, they moved out to Australia. And the plan was to just be here for a few years and then move back to England. Unfortunately, her husband had a few financial difficulties.
He was a pastoralist, wasn't he?
Initially, yeah. He actually ended up becoming quite a famous politician in Tasmania. But he had quite a few setbacks before he moved into politics. And they ended up moving to Tasmania, I think, for financial reasons. I suspect they thought they could probably make their living down there. But they had more bad luck. And during that time, she painted a lot of mostly wildflowers, but she animated her paintings with insects, particularly butterflies and moths. Mm. I guess she was a decorative an artist, not so much a taxonomist, but she was a decorative painter who painted for enjoyment. But she was also very forthright about her views about society and what she saw. She believed strongly in principles of conservation, that the areas should be left aside, and that the plants and the wildlife were something special, not to be just destroyed and trashed.
One warms to the woman, as did the Tasmanian government, because, and it wasn't common, I take it, she was awarded an annual pension for, quote, "the considerable services to the cause of science, literature and art in Tasmania."
Yeah, it's fantastic, isn't it? The way back then that award was given. So I guess that really reflects the high opinion that was held at the time.
This is Ali Nell on ABC Radio National, and we're talking about a butter of flutterbys. No, we're not a flutter of butterflies. That's the name of the book that showcases the art and science of some of Australia's early flutterby enthusiasts, and author Michael Braby is my guest. Okay, let's move on to Alice Rowan. We know a little bit about Alice on this program. She was even more independent, wasn't she? She left behind her husband and son in Melbourne, latter half of the 19th century, and heads off to Queensland, to Papua, New Guinea, the Himalayas, the West Indies, heavens above, chasing butterflies thither and yon, along with, of course, exotic flowers.
Yeah, she certainly travelled around, and she... She spent a lot of her time in northern Queensland. She was primarily interested in plants. She had a close connection with the government botanist of Victoria, Von Mueller, and she exchanged specimens. She drew paintings of the plants. But she, in quite a number of her paintings, she was prolific. She painted thousands of illustrations, but she occasionally would add insects, and particularly butterflies from northern Queensland. I haven't seen any paintings of plants from the southern part of Australia where she's included insects, but certainly her experiences in northern Queensland and Papua New Guinea, she starts to include illustrations of insects. So again, I suspect it's probably to improve the composition of her artwork. She did get to know F.P. Dodd, the famous butterfly man of Caranda, spent many hours on his property. And perhaps through that connection, I don't know, but it's quite interesting that she's really, I guess, just got this love and enjoyment in painting beautiful insects.
I like this story about Christian missionaries trading Bibles for butterflies.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you still do that when you know in your wanderings? Do you swap Bibles for butterflies?
It's a good idea, isn't it? I should try.
You can always find a Bible in the drawer in your lonely motel rooms. Knock it off and then swap it for a butterfly.
Yeah. No, I think when I've worked in New Guinea, I've tended to take tobacco and rice, but I never thought about taking Bibles.
The Victorian Artists Society wasn't that happy when Rowan scooped the pearl at the 1888 Centennial International Exhibition, because she jumped the head of a queue with people like Tom Roberts in it.
Yeah, look, my co-author Penny Olson, she actually prepared a lot of the biographies for the individual artists, and she could probably give a bit more insight into that. But I think it's quite interesting that her work was highly, highly valued. But I think the other thing is that, I think there was always this debate about whether her work was art or science, and I think that really dogged her most of her life.
Well, when she offered a collection to the Nation said no thanks.
That's right.
Because they couldn't work out how to
they didn't know where it went.
where to put her, did they?
That's right, yeah. And I think eventually went to the museum, so... I suppose that's more science, but I don't think it really matters. I think the fact that her work is highly accurate, it's highly detailed. You can identify all the species in her paintings. The butterflies are extremely accurate. You can identify every species right down to even the ones in New Guinea. So I think it just shows that period that. People had this real connection between those two disciplines, that the art on the one hand and the science on the other.
I think wireless is much better than television, but right at this minute I just wish we did have a camera so I could riffle through the book and show the Gladys just how extraordinarily beautiful these paintings are we're talking about. And that takes us to the other aspects of the butterfly, the mythologizing, the poetry, there's a lot to the butterfly in our culture.
That's right. And I think, the 30-odd years I've kind of been interested in butterflies, I never thought I'd end up working on them professionally, but I don't think I've actually met anyone who doesn't like butterflies. There's something about I'm not quite sure what it is, but something about their colour and the way they fly, perhaps, and their beauty. They seem to really resonate with all sectors, you know, whether it's poetry, whether it's art, or whether it's science.
There's something else about them too. They're like the old-fashioned rose before they were sort of hybridised, and yeah. That is, they don't last long. There's something, they're fleeting, aren't they?
Yes, that's a good point, yes. And many of them don't, the adult stage doesn't live for that long, like, I guess anywhere from a few days to a few months, but... So maybe it's something about their transitory presence in the environment.
Are there passionate butterfly chasers in the 21st century, Michael?
There are, actually. We have, in this country, we have quite a number of very keen collectors. And I guess the hobby of collecting specimens for a collection is probably not as fashionable as it was 100, 150 years ago, but there's still people who do that. I myself can't stop collecting the old specimen.
Do you go darting around the landscape with one of those lovely sort of nets on a pole? Is that what you do?
I have a range of nets, actually.
Do you?
Yeah, for different purposes. So for canopy things, you need a long pole, and for things that fly close to the ground, you need a shorter net.
So if any of the listeners see you sort of leaping towards them, swishing your pole around, they should not be alarmed.
They should not be alarmed, that's right. but I think, yeah, I have noticed there's been a trend lately to photograph butterflies. So
the curse of the camera.
Yeah, and we're kind of heading more like the birdos, you know, the birdos probably don't shoot their birds anymore, they tick them off. So I think the butterfly people are becoming tickers, but they tick them off on their camera.
Just down the road from my farm, there's a farm with a huge collection of birds, you know, and also eggs, perfectly preserved after the best part of 100 years. How long does a carefully looked after dead butterfly survive?
If it's kept in the right conditions, so that, you know, that it's kept out of the dark and it's kept in low humidity and the temperature's reasonably low, there's no reason why it can't last for hundreds of years.
And we don't. You're really kidding? Know, really?
No. We know that from specimens in England that have survived in excess of 300 years. So we only assume that the specimens in our country would last just as long, if not longer. So
that would be an eerie feeling to look at something as fragile as a butterfly.
And to think the
little bugger was 300 years old.
And in the British Museum, you can actually see Joseph Banks' collection, the species he actually collected from Australia. They have them all laid out in a display box. And a colleague of mine saw them a few years ago, and he was quite shocked or stunned at how well-preserved they were, the condition that they were in. It almost looked as if they were just collected yesterday.
Good on you, Michael. Michael Raby's been prancing and dancing around the studio, waving his net around, and he's an entomologist with the Northern Territory Government. And the book, written with Penny Olsen, is called A Flutter of Butterflies. The pages are as beautiful as a butterfly's wings, and it's published by those splendid people at the National Library of Australia. On our next Sleeping with the Enemy, we'll be discussing Coco Chanel's Secret War. And to quote Peter Cundall, that's your lot. For more information about any of the interviews, you can visit our website on abc.net.au/rn/late-night-live. We'd be obliged if you stuck around now for the news on ABC Radio National, and we'll see you later.